W. Thank you, Eric and Rich. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. This is the beginning of Technet number 1615 of the series that began way back in 1982 in September. So we're coming up on 34 years, or 33 and a fraction years of Technet so far. And for those who don't have the ability to stay up so late and hear the whole thing, there's a very dedicated guy named Mike Number One, KC2 NJI, who has this beautiful website where the last 10 solid years of TechNet are recorded. And the one that we're creating tonight, a couple of days downrange, it'll be at that recording. And that website where you can play back all of the recordings of the TechNet is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and start playing those recordings. The first few years of them were even cross-referenced. Mike was so enthusiastic, he would take each one of our many subjects, like for instance, standing wave ratio, and list all of the days and times when that particular subject was discussed. Let me drop. Another website that supports the TechNet is Mike Number Two, K1MJM, and that's mymarktechnet.com, mymarktechnet.com, and there you'll see graphs, photographs, articles, other material that supports the TechNet. Smith chart, for instance, and the Brown and Woodward curves, and pictures of antennas. The antennas that you're listening to, so to speak. You guys have heard this done many times before. The TechNet's main purpose is education. A significant percentage of real ham radio operators, in my opinion, are the ones that have real curiosity. They're amazed by the fact that a small amount of radio power, sometimes QRP, applied to an antenna, goes out there into the ether, into the empty space, and tens, hundreds, or thousands of miles away, somebody hears that signal and communication is established. How in the world does that radio signal sift through all of those trees, buildings, mountains, and everything else, Earth curvature, and bounce off the ionosphere and get there? How does it do that? Some of us are very, very enthralled by that, and we spend a lifetime to some degree studying it. I've got some theories as to what a radio wave really is, and my theory is this. Differ a little bit from the classic way it's taught. Let me drop it. I believe that radio wave is primarily a magnetic wave. I think the voltage of that TEM, transverse electromagnetic wave, the voltage component only occurs when the wave hits a wire, a conductor, your antenna, and then it induces a voltage. But in free space itself, I'm not convinced the voltage is there. But that's another whole discussion. There's a beautiful offer going to be made to you guys tonight, and that is we all have Baofengs and Waxons, which, according to the owner's manual, they teach you how to program it from the front panel. And most of us use the computer program and a cable to program the thing because it's so difficult to program from the front panel. Its method of programming is very different from any of the rigs we've used before. However, the day will happen when you're in the field, at a remote site, away from a computer, without your cable, and you'd like to be able to program a brand new repeater or a brand new frequency into the handy-talkie by way of the front panel. And so there was a beautiful article way back in last year's issue of Rochester Amateur Radio Corporation, RARA. And that was, let's see, what issue was that? Anyhow, this guy, Mike, Correction Rich, Rich WB2 GXM, Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf Extreme Mike, has found that article, duplicated that page. The page that was in that issue tells you how to program the thing in a way that's user-friendly, and the page folds up very nicely into a wallet-sized 8-page document, which tells you how to do programming. Let me drop it. Now, Rich has access to a very very nice printing machine. So he's made up a number of these wallet-sized manuals for the Waxon. So if you send a self-addressed stamped envelope to Rich, WB2 Golf X-Ray Mike, and his address is listed in QRZ.com, you will get in return one of these very nice wallet-sized manuals telling you how to program your Waxon from the front panel, or Baofeng from the front panel. Let me drop. Now, the TechNet itself, which you're listening to, is a gathering of guys who want to know more about radio, want to know more about how their antenna, the transmission line, the transmitter, the receiver, propagation, all of that jazz. 27 different kinds of ham radio, and they want to know more about them. And so they gather here, ask each other questions, and those questions get answered live on the air. For those people who don't yet have the right license or the right equipment to talk to us directly, John, KC2WGB, runs the so-called mailbag, and you send him a message, WB2GXM, here we go, KC2WGB, you send him a message, and he selects 2, 3, 4 of those that have general interest, and we discuss them. So the first hour of the TechNet is where we take sign-in questions and answers, somebody might have an announcement they want to make. Then that's followed by the mailbag, and that's followed by Paul, WS2N, who will be giving us space report number either 214 or 215. My numbering says 214, but I may have seen, I see what I did. No, I didn't skip. So I think it's 214, he thinks it's 215. Minor detail. But what is National Aeronautics and Space Administration doing? What are all the other worldwide space agencies doing? Paul has spent a good fraction of his lifetime studying those particular people and their pieces of hardware. Let me drop. And he gives us the latest on what they're doing. So at this time, we're going to take check-ins for people who do have a question or an announcement, a question or a comment, let's call it. You need that sign-in just because you're listening. After 33 years and many thousands of hours of TechNet, by now we believe somebody is listening. So give me your call letter and name if you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KC2WGB, John, and yes. So give me your call letters and name right now. K2LAW listening.
XM with a follow-up comment.
Okay, Rich recognized. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
K2EJ, Eric, yes.
Okay, so far we got Rich with a comment, Eric, probably with a real question. Anyone else to sign in to the TechNet with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2N. Yes, I doubled before. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, there's a rare guy. And, okay, so far we get Rich, Eric, and Paul. And one more call. Anybody who does have a question or a comment for the TechNet, give me your call letters and name right now. K2LAW listening. Okay. After we go through those three guys, and if we have a little bit of time left over, I'll call once again and see if anyone else has got a question. So, Rich, I may have misquoted you a little bit on your beautiful offer for this wallet-sized 8-page manual on programming a Baofeng. So fill us in, WB2GXM, K2LAW, you got it, Rich.
Dick, you did wonderfully. Thank you very much for helping me with this small project. I work at a print shop, and the Baofeng UV5R wallet-sized manual, I took that and printed that on professional stock, and it is UV glazed so that it resists wear. And it's scored to fold it into your nice little wallet-sized card. And, Dick, on the off chance that people don't have access to QRZ, should I give them the PO box number? WB2GXM.
It's such a beautiful offer, obviously. So, I wave WB2GXM, QRZ.com. Go there and plug in those call letters. You'll find out his address. But he would like you to send him a self-addressed stamped envelope for you to receive this beautiful professional stock wallet-sized manual. But give us any information you want to, Rich. WB2GXM, K2IW, go ahead.
Thank you. The alternative address that you can send the self-addressed stamped envelope to is me, Richard Spone. I spell that Sierra Papa Oscar Howard November, WB2GXM, Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike, P.O. Box 187, Floral Park, New York, 11001. Also, obviously, if you're listening to this on the archive, that offer stands for a while. WB2GXM.
That's a nice address you've got. You're one of those lucky guys where your zip code, your zip code is a binary number. 11001. And with a little bit of fiddling, we'll find out exactly what binary number it is. Maybe it's a 31. So, okay. Post Office Box 187. Any with any further questions or fills on the subject of this wallet-sized, professionally printed manual for your iPhone? Give me your call letters right now. K2IW, the Tech Man. Okay, thank you very much, Rich. That's a beautiful offer. Now, Eric, KE2EJ. With all of your experience with all of those broadcast FM transmitters, AM transmitters, television transmitters, analog, digital, with all of your experience with New York Institute of Technology when it comes to computer-generated graphics, artificial intelligence, with all of that background, how in the world could you have a question on the subject of radio and wireless electronics? You've been deep into it for essentially every year of your life. How in the world could you have a question? I'm having some fun with them, as you can tell. KE2EJ, K2IW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2IW, K2EJ. First of all, can you hear me okay?
You sound beautiful. Just the right amount of audio and plenty of RF. Please proceed. Hi-Fi.
All right, well, I'm not in my usual spot. Actually, got to step away for a minute, but after this, it should be quick. It should be of interest to everyone. Well, let me make a long story short. I got something called a modulation monitor for an FM station, of all things. It's basically a device with no front end, an oscillator, a mixer, and then it goes about its business checking out the frequency, which is based on a ovenized crystal. Everything works except for the oscillator. I checked all the components around the oscillator and decided that I must have a problem with the crystal. So, my question to you, sir, is I used to have a board which I made which is basically a simply modified Coleman's oscillator with a switch so I could use parallel cut or a series cut crystal, loaded crystal plate, one, you know, being an AT cut type crystal. Without that, okay, now let's say I've got a questionable crystal in my hand, and I got various different devices. I've got ohmmeters, I've got the spectrum analyzer, retracting generator, I've got VNA, I've got signal generator. What approach would you take, given not actually building up an oscillator to test it? How would you test that crystal and say, yay, it's good, or nay, it's bad? K2IW, K3J.
My first impression, which, by the way, was formed in the last 10 years of my operation at a particular company where, day in and day out, I was using a vector network analyzer, developing antennas that tried to have extremely low standing wave ratio. I'm talking about 1.05 to 1 is what the specification now is working to, from 902 to 928 megs. So once they've supplied for me at this company a beautiful Rode & Schwarz vector network analyzer that goes up to 8 gigs, I fell in love with that thing. Before that, I had previously used in 10 years back the Hewlett-Packard vector network analyzers, and I had learned to hate vector network analyzers. So complete reversal. A crystal, I presume it's fundamental, but it could be a higher harmonic.
30 megahertz. Actually, multiply it by 3 and subtract, add 650 kilohertz, and you've got the actual floating frequency.
Did you say 10 megahertz, Eric?
30. Multiply that by 3, it gets you into the FM band, and the IF is 650 kilohertz.
At the desired operating frequency, a crystal has to provide an extremely precise frequency of resonance with a very well-known amount of equivalent series resistance. In other words, the equivalent circuit of the crystal for the series mode and the parallel mode, and that's all predictable ahead of time. I think the earlier versions of the Radio Amateurs Handbook gave you a curve of what the crystal would really look like. Exact impedance versus frequency. As long as your vector network analyzer has very fine resolution, a good frequency synthesizer, so it could go down to 100 hertz steps, so to speak, and maybe even 10 hertz steps, maybe even 1 hertz steps, you build the right kind of a holder for that crystal, have the right kind of a cable at the end of the test cable that goes from the front panel of the vector network analyzer up to your crystal holder, and at 30 megacycles, in the worst case, you could even get away with tiny alligator clips. And you could calibrate. Well, calibrating at the end of the cable becomes a little bit difficult. But when you measure the exact impedance of that crystal at the desired frequency, 30 megs, it'll tell you immediately, does it have the right series resistance, if it's the series mode you're using. And in the series mode, the series resistance is very important. And is the resonant frequency where it's supposed to be? You get an extremely fast sweep of reactive component. It swings from the inductive reactive component to the capacitive reactive. I get it backwards. From capacitive to inductive, it swings extremely fast over a frequency of about 10 hertz at the resonant frequency. So that DNA, properly calibrated, is going to tell you everything you could have dreamed about that crystal. And once you've got those two curves, the resistive component and the reactive component, display it on a Smith chart if you like. But Smith chart, X, Y, once you start...
Repeater, timeout.
Once you study what the crystal is supposed to do, compared to your particular crystal, and when in doubt, pick up another crystal that you know is a good one, and compare the two.
If I had that, I wouldn't be asking the question now, would I?
Okay. When it comes to just what a crystal looks like, the 30 megacycle crystal most likely is a third overtone. It might not be fundamental. You can grind a fundamental that high. I think they tend to use it as a third overtone. It's really a 10 meg crystal. Is that a good guess, Eric? Go ahead.
My experience, things up that high usually third overtone.
Yeah, as you take a piece of quartz and set it up as a resonator, it's an electromechanical resonator, piezoelectric effect. You apply voltage, it bends a little bit. You bend it, and it generates a voltage, so it's a positive feedback-like mechanism, if you know what I mean. And so series mode or parallel mode, depending on your particular kind of oscillator. I think the really high-quality oscillators tend to be series mode, but at 30 megacycles, at a third overtone, it's going to have a very specific characteristic. And you might, by way of sweeping it with finer and finer resolution, in other words, less and less megacycles from start to finish of your vector network analyzer plot, you'll eventually find out exactly what it's doing, what its spurious modes are, how many dB down are they. While you're at it, go ahead and take a look at the fundamental mode at 10 megs, but the 10 meg fundamental mode doesn't matter as much. The way it acts at 30 megs is going to tell you everything. Let me drop it.
WGB to comment.
Gonna pick up with John in about a minute. The way an oscillator works, every oscillator we have ever touched, is an amplifier circuit with positive feedback. That's it. Amplifier circuit, usually with a resonator, and positive feedback. At the desired operating frequency, the total loop gain must be greater than 1, must be greater than unity, like 1.01 or 1.1 is the loop gain. Once the loop gain is greater than 1, the slightest amount of noise of your oscillating transistor starts the action. Very rapidly, the oscillation builds up. Because it's got greater than unity gain, the oscillator with feedback is trying to make an amplitude of signal on the output of the oscillator that goes to infinity. It's got more than unity gain, therefore the signal is going to continuously build up until something goes into limiting. In almost all cases, the thing that goes into limiting is the amplifying transistor. So the amplifying transistor, eventually, if you had more than 1 dB of excess gain in the loop, by definition, it'll build up until you have exactly 1 dB of limiting. So at the oscillating frequency, your amplifier oscillator, your amplifier with feedback, will have 1.00000 amplitude ratio, if you know what I mean, because of the limiting characteristic. And so does your circuit have, you can also open up the loop of the oscillator and measure what is the loop gain with the transistor, with the crystal plugged in at the oscillating frequency. Again, you can do that with the vector network analyzer, but the crystal itself is the thing you're now suspicious of. There's lots of articles we can, let me drop it. There's a good number of articles on websites that'll tell you what is a third overtone crystal, what is the exact impedance supposed to look like at the resonant frequency. And many quartz crystals built with quality can have an oscillating Q of near 100,000. That means the stored energy per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle has a ratio of 100,000. There are ways of making a crystal in a vacuum environment which approach a million. So when it comes to very finely tuned devices, quartz crystal is very hard to top. I guess a cesium beam and a rubidium beam comes a little bit higher, but that's a very elaborate circuit. So I wonder how many crystals have you measured, John? I vaguely remember either you or was it Mel? Yeah, it was Mel. He was involved in, let me drop it. He was involved in building a crystal lattice filter where he had either three or four crystals all on the exact frequency tied together in a circuit in order to make a very high performance IF strip oscillator for a single sideband transmitter. KC2WGB, tell us whatever you know about crystal oscillators, Eric. John, keep your eyes up. You got it, John.
KC2WGB, good evening, Dick. Eric, everyone on the net. What works for me when I have instrumentation and I think I have a bad crystal in, what I've done in the past, and it seems to work pretty smoothly in all situations, I take one of my very accurate generators, I generate that specific frequency and loosely couple it into the crystal circuit and see if the instrument comes to life. No, it's not going to be exactly what you want as far as accuracy, but it's close enough to get the instrument operating. And then you know the crystal's bad, not enough activity. That works for me, and it was a lot easier than trying to build a crystal test unit, which is possible to do also.
Well, the so-called crystal test unit is really just a way of holding the crystal. If you had a piece of coaxial cable where the end of the cable is calibrated, by that I mean you've got a connector on the end, an SMA connector, and you put in your short, open, and load SMA reference devices to calibrate the cable. That SMA connector, in turn, is essentially plugged into a crystal holder. And the little bit of extra inductance and capacitance you get from the holder is minor compared to the activity of the crystal. So the calibration of your holder is a minor detail. At 30 megacycles, which is what, 15 meters or so, 10 meters. 10 meters, 30 feet. A wavelength is 10 feet. Your little bitty clip leads are 1/10,000th of a wavelength long, so the amount of disturbance they are giving to the measurement is extremely minor. I'd like to, when you hook your vector network analyzer up to that crystal, There are various ways you can open up the loop, the feedback loop of the oscillator, and confirm whether or not at 30.0 megahertz, the loop has greater than unity gain. If you measure 10 dB of loss in the loop, then is it the crystal causing it? By putting a bypass capacitor across the crystal, you can find out whether or not the loop gain is there. If the crystal is being used in the series mode, the crystal itself is not multiplying voltage, if you know what I mean. It's acting as a short circuit at the desired frequency. So, is there any suspicion that the oscillating transistor has become defective? KE2EJ, K2IW in the TechNet.
XDPZ. Dick, could you fill me in? I just got on. I'm very familiar with oscillators and oscillator design.
Yeah, let me turn it back to Eric, because I've got a whole lot of questions he's going to answer first. KE2EJ, K2LAW, go ahead, Eric.
K2LAW, K2EJ. Well, John, injecting a signal doesn't always tell you the truth. That's my comment to that. Actually, I put together a little LC circuit at the frequency to see if the oscillator is actually oscillating, and it does. And there's good gain in the transistor, and it's real simple. I mean, really simple. But what I can't figure is this is a high-quality, high-end ovenized crystal. I'm just trying to figure out what kind of failure modes am I really running into. Again, I used to have a breadboard, which I can't find, but you can plug just about any crystal in and make it sing. But I can't find that, so I'm looking at alternate methods of confirming it, because essentially you have to order another crystal, get it ground. You know, it's going to take 3-4 weeks for them to finish it up and package it, so that was the reason for the question. Although I'm pretty damn confident that crystal is no good, but failure modes. What kind of failure modes are we really running into? I mean, this thing's been running for 20 years, and all of a sudden it's stopped running.
CPC, can I make a comment?
Yes, right after I make mine, Hal. Any possibility that it experienced a very heavy shock was dropped. I mean, mechanical failure is the most likely failure.
Let me tell you what happened.
Go right ahead.
The oscillator is designed to run at 15 volts. It's a stable 15 volt regulator. It's part of another part of the circuit. One of the transistors opened up. It's Zener controlled path transistor type circuit. And so that oscillator was getting 30 volts instead of 15. So right there is probably the causal effects of the failure. I mean, that's all been repaired. I got my 15 volts back nice and clean. I got good gain through the oscillator and the stages after it. There was a bunch of stuff that was bad because the voltage went up so high. These are older components, you know, they're like 2N2222s, 2N2102s, those kinds of transistors. And in those days, they didn't tolerate going outside their limits too much.
Eric, you've hit the nail on the head. Every crystal oscillator has a maximum voltage beyond which you're not supposed to excite it, because it is a mechanical device, piezoelectric. In other words, you apply a voltage, it does a certain amount of bending of the device, and you apply twice the normal voltage, 30 volts instead of 15, which means you're putting four times as much power into the crystal. Therefore, not only did it deflect more than it's supposed to, and it quite possibly cracked, but it also experienced overheating. So was it overheating that did you cook it to death, or did you crack it to death because of overexcitation? You being a scientist, once you get the right crystal in there and get it operating again, it'll be fun to take apart the old one and see what you see under your stereo zoom microscope that I think by now you probably own. But extra voltage can kill a crystal right away. Let's see if Hal agrees with that. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Hal.
Okay, first of all, I agree with that.
push a crystal too hard and start having enough piece of quartz gonna crack it. Okay, here's how you check a crystal very easily. You take a signal generator. You cut off a coaxial lead from the generator, go to a 2-puff capacitor, take a scope, take another 2-puff capacitor in series with the lead from the scope, put the crystal in between those 2-puff capacitors to ground. So you're coupling the crystal in parallel. You have the lead to the generator, 2 puffs, crystal to ground, go on the same high end of the crystal, 2 puffs to the scope. Swing the generator through the crystal frequency. The crystal, if it's good, will pop in, switch it on the scope, at the operating frequency. If the crystal is shot, it will not pop up at the oscillation. Very easy way to check. Third overtone crystals, fundamental crystals, or what have you. It works. Go ahead. K6DPZ. K6DPZ.
Okay. That's one approach, but I think the slightly more... That's a good approach. But a slightly more sophisticated approach because he has access to a very high-quality vector network analyzer. There's an exact swept impedance that crystal should provide. And so by way of your VNA curve, you'll now know not only is it good or bad, but you'll know exactly how many dB good or bad. In the series mode, maybe the crystal is supposed to have an insertion loss of 1 dB, and maybe you're going to measure 15 dB. Maybe you're going to see no resonance at all at 30 megacycles by either Howell's test or the VNA test. But the way you put extra voltage on there for some period of time, and do you have any reason, any way of knowing, Eric, let me drop this. Do you have any way of knowing how long ago the series regulator failed where the 15 volts went to 30? Do you believe the oscillator did operate for an hour, so to speak, at 30 volts? Or do you have reason to believe that the failure of your regulator and the failure of the oscillator were one and the same? But that poor thing has been cooked, and I think there's a 90-some-odd % chance you're going to have to buy another crystal, as Eric. I don't think he is restorable after you have cooked him with 30 volts. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Hi, K2IW, K2EJ. I'm kind of in agreement with that. I will say that the actual oven temperature is about 150 degrees Fahrenheit? Is it 150 Fahrenheit or is it 150 C? I guess. Anyway, damn hot. Because, you know, this is the old day of making an oven out of a hunk of metal and you can't put your hand on it until about 10 or 15 minutes after you shut it off. I don't forget it. Been in operation for 20 years in Iraq at a transmitter site, so as to when the failure actually occurs, well, that's indeterminate. And I can narrow it down to a week, but not to a bunch of hours.
There was somebody trying to sign in, but he didn't make it. The combination of the high temperature oven, which gives you great stabilization of frequency, and they push that to the point where you don't want too much extra heating of the crystal beyond the oven. And 30 volts versus 15, boy, did you cook that poor thing. You're going to have to buy another crystal. And maybe you want to replace the whole damn crystal oscillator assembly, Eric. If this is a commercial product that's part of a broadcast station, just replacing the whole assembly is one way to go. And maybe you're going to acquire this broken oscillator and you'd like to put it on your shelf and put it back into operation. I think I'm going to make a guess that was Hal trying to get in. K6TPZ, K2LIW, go ahead, Hal.
That's something which I'm writing an article about called a handy probe. Basically, you take a pill bottle, you put a pointer in the pill bottle, I use a long screw, you come in with 2 pieces of coax, I used RG-174, one from the signal generator, one from the scope. You use two puff capacitors, one on each side. The shields, you bring out the clip lead, and you have a handy probe. And with that, you can check resonance and tune circuits. You can check crystals. It saved my neck on many things, the troubleshooting. It's very easy to build, and I was doing an article for ER for it. Go ahead, Deb.
Sounds good. So I'm more interested in not a go-no-go test that it either does or doesn't oscillate, it does or doesn't have throughput characteristics. But by way of the vector network analyzer, you'll be able to resolve if it's supposed to have 1 dB of loss and it's got 21 dB of loss at the desired frequency, or no frequency of resonance at all near a 30 megs because of the crack or the cooking. I think it's a high probability you're going to find out that crystal developed a crack or it's got burned contacts from overheating. So, are you going to acquire that defective oscillator? It's going to become something on your shelf after you fix it, and the whole assembly is going to be replaced at this broadcast station, Eric, KEQEJ, KQRIW, and the Tech Man.
One more comment. How many people support Sector F? That's all. I'm calling about it. It's cheap, simple, and dirty, with just average components. Hand may have a scope and a signal generator to crystals. You're talking laboratory standards. Come on, just be real here, Dick.
Okay, that, whoever that person was only in there 50% of the time, but I can tell he's angry. Eric has access to a vector network analyzer. I'm not recommending everybody do it that way. The way Hal was recommending with two picofarad capacitors in a pill bottle from a single generator is a very nice, simple way of doing it. But Eric has access to some of the world's best vector network analyzers. And he, being a scientist that he is, he'd like to know specifically what is the number of decibels of failure. KE2EJ, KQRIW, that'd be great, Eric.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Well, actually, that was going to be the second part of the question, is if you were someone that didn't happen to have that nice handy device. And Hal's method of description is a nice way to go. But since I have that at my access, that's why I brought that up. You got to remember, this is a public station. Essentially, they beg for money. So, I mean, we could just take $2,000 and buy a nice new monitor, but they're not going to do that. And as far as, like, getting a whole nother oscillator assembly, that's not happening either. They don't make it. So, I mean, I just looked at it finally yesterday, and I didn't dive too deep. I just went, fixed what I fixed it so far, and then came to the point of, why is it not oscillating? And then I quickly put together a little LC just to make sure the oscillator, the electronics around it was working. And so I thought it would be a good question to bring up, is what approach would you take to test it, assuming you don't have another oscillator to plug it into. And by the way, the oscillator is real simple. It's some modified Colpitts.
Frequency crystal, do you need, Eric?
30.00, isn't that true, Eric? Go ahead. Word overtone.
Yeah. There's a resonator and a capacitor that lets you tune it from a whole FM band. So it's basically multiplied by 3, and the IF for this particular thing is 650. So you're running between, 27 megahertz and 34, 35. It's designed to swing through the whole FM band.
Run that by again.
Third overtones, I'll give it to you. A public service, what the hell?
When it comes to the so-called rubberized crystal technique, which was used by the KLM company.
Repeater, timeout.
The KLM transmitter, I think it was KLM, was the brand name of Mike Stahl, K6MYC, was selling these things, the 432 crystal plexa type thing. It had a very special crystal that was so-called rubberized. In other words, this crystal, by way of putting a variable capacitor near it, you could pull it a whole lot of megacycles. An ordinary third overtone crystal that's used for frequency reference, I'd be amazed if you could pull it more than 10 kilohertz at 30 megacycles. So this...
You're misunderstanding me.
Okay, run it by again. What was tuning 27 to 33 megs? That doesn't sound like it's another oscillator. It's not the crystal reference oscillator. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
No. The crystal operates on a single frequency. If your radio station is at 90.1, you order a crystal at 30.5, whatever it is. If you're going to be monitoring a station that's 107, you're ordering a 35 megahertz, whatever it is.
follow. It's just that the operator is designed to operate within, I think it's the FM band. Nine megahertz, 10 megahertz. So, that was all I was saying, is that the oscillator is designed to operate on any one of those frequencies.
Let me know the crystal, I'll give it to you as a gift for public service radio, okay?
Very attractive offer. Let me drop. I think the FM band goes from 88 to 108. It's 20 megs wide. But one-third of that frequency, one-third of 28 megs is six and a fraction megs of bandwidth on your third overtone crystal. Now, because this is a specific reference oscillator for a specific FM station, to get it into operation, you can try a crystal that's anywhere from 27 to 33 megs. But ultimately, I suspect you need the exact frequency of oscillation of that crystal in order to act as a reference for that particular broadcast FM station. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
That's correct. K2RIW, K2EJ. Whatever your operating frequency is, divide that by 3, and take 650 and divide that by 3, and you've got the frequency of the crystal that you want.
Eric, when you have a chance, call me on the phone, tell me the frequency of the crystal you want. Chances are I've got it, okay?
Oh, I seriously doubt that. You want to know the exact frequency of the crystal? It's 30.5833 megahertz.
Third overtones in those ranges, Eric. Call me. I'll pull a crystal for you. Is it the F605 holder? What size holder?
No, I have no problem ordering one from International Crystal. They know what the holder size. They know all the parameters of the crystal, so they'll manufacture exactly what's needed. And they'll manufacture it so that it's fully compensated when it's sitting in their cabin.
Needed to get back on the air, I'll lift up a crystal so you get International. I don't care.
I have no idea what it is, that hell. Anyway, so that's my story.
Yeah, you need 30.5833 to the nearest fraction of a kilohertz in order to be used as the frequency reference. I presume that oscillator lets them know whether or not their FM broadcast station is 200 hertz high or 200 hertz low on its average center frequency. Is that approximately what goes on, Eric? Or it's a monitoring device that's also used for looking at the fidelity of the signal being transmitted. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
KE2RIW, K2EJ. It tells you exactly whether you're on frequency or how far off frequency you are. There's actually a little trimmer cap there to put it precisely on frequency based on some external reference. It does actually tell you how much deviation or how much they do it, the percentage of modulation you have. There's another segment of it that will actually tell you whether your pilot's on frequency, whether the 38 kilohertz is right where it belongs and what level it's at, and it will also give you the individual components in terms of audio of left and right channel, and any SDAs that you might happen to be running it at that particular point in time.
Broadcast station monitor.
And so they've been operating without their monitor, and that failed in the last week or so. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, it failed last week. But what I use for an exciter, I don't worry about it, because the exciter actually does not make FM in the traditional fashion. It does it completely by calculus.
In other words, I think you're telling me that the generator is a direct digital synthesizer. Over to you, Eric.
Well, you can think of it as a DDS, but it's not a DDS in the traditional sense. It doesn't have a oscillator which is running a lookup table, which is making a sine wave for the output as a traditional DDS does. this actually does the oscillator based on a clock, and it's at the totally through arithmetic, exactly a DSP that's generating it.
While we're on the subject of oscillators, I'm going to give you guys another interesting piece of information that I ran into, and that is every oscillator is an amplifier with feedback greater than unity of feedback. Therefore, the oscillation, once it starts, it wants to go to infinity. The only thing that limits it from going to infinity, most of the time, is that the amplifying device runs into, let me pick a number, 1 dB of amplitude compression. You're at that particular amplitude, and that's the amplitude at which you will oscillate. The good news is now you've got a nice oscillator on exactly the right frequency. Unfortunately, your amplifying device of your oscillator is in some amount of limiting, depending on how much excess gain you've got. And you could back off on the amount of limiting by lowering the loop gain. And now you're walking a very narrow fence. You want enough gain to make sure it has a guaranteed startup, but you want very little excess gain, so you're not creating harmonics. When an amplifying stage is into 1 dB of limiting, so to speak, it is by definition making a second harmonic that is approximately 20 dB down. If you need a pure oscillator, where you want all harmonics to be suppressed by, let me pick a number, 30, 40, 50 dB, the designing that oscillator at first sounds really difficult. Hewlett-Packard solved that problem beautifully in roughly 1940. Let me drop.
Light bulb.
That's it. The Hewlett-Packard Model 200 audio oscillator, which goes from roughly 10 hertz to 1 megahertz inclusive. It is a Wheatstone Bridge resistive capacitive oscillator, stable as all hell, and that oscillator stage, which was using a dual triode tube, I think it was a 6S77 in the original design, puts out the purest sine wave you've ever seen. So how in the world does this oscillator be so pure, so little drift, because there is no inductor in there, just a resistor, capacitor, Wheatstone Bridge circuit determining the resonant frequency, and the oscillator by definition has to go to amplitude limiting. They did it by putting a carefully chosen light bulb in the cathode of the oscillating tube. As the one of the things that's not very well known by a lot of people is that an incandescent light bulb, when it's ice cold, has roughly 1/10 the resistance it has when it's hot. Let me drop.
Bridge oscillator. I can tell you more about HP on that one, Dick.
That's what I just said, Wheatstone Bridge oscillator. But by using that carefully chosen incandescent light bulb in the cathode circuit, as the oscillation builds up, it puts extra voltage into that light bulb, so the resistance changes, and therefore the resistance of the light bulb, a pure resistance across the sine wave, determines exactly where 1 dB of, where the loop gain is exactly unity, and that oscillator has harmonic output that is suppressed by a huge number of dB. The reason they did it that way is because that oscillator going into your audio circuit that's under test, let me drop.
Comment.
That oscillator goes through your audio circuit that you're testing, then goes into a Hewlett-Packard total distortion analyzer. What does the total distortion analyzer do? If you're doing a test at, say, 1 kilohertz, the total distortion analyzer, another very famous Hewlett-Packard circuit. I can't think of the model number of that thing right now. Let me drop.
30. 30, I believe it is, Dick.
I keep hearing 30. You squeeze the mic and talk simultaneously, so we're always missing the beginning of your conversation. What was the model number, Eric? I mean, Hal? Squeeze the mic, wait a second, and then tell us the model number.
I believe it's HP330 Distortion Analyzer, but I just wanted to say, the Weinbridge Oscillator, it's a patent by Hewlett-Packard, Mark David and Hewlett-Packard, that mainly started the company. I don't know, Dick, if you know the story. I can tell you the story. It's very interesting. Those first oscillators were ordered by Disney Studios, and that's what got Hewlett-Packard started.
And I think Disney Studios used those oscillators to design the sound effects in the background of their early movie called Fantasia. Is that possibly where they first got used? Hal, go ahead.
They had an order from Disney Studios, and those oscillators that they built were the beginning of Hewitt Packard. That was the seed money that got Hewitt Packard started. And it was a Weinbridge oscillator, that's the full name of it, and tungsten bulb to maintain constant output. You're very right on that. But that was the beginning of Hewitt Packard, thanks to Walt Disney.
That pure oscillator, which runs from roughly 10 hertz or 20 hertz up to near 1 megahertz, puts out the purest sine wave you've ever seen, no drift to it, because that, some people pronounce it Weinbridge, I pronounce it Weinbridge, doesn't matter, but it's an RC bridge network. In other words, you draw a diamond and you put the four components on the four sides of that diamond are either a resistor or a variable capacitor, and so that thing has a very precise frequency of resonance. That's where the oscillator is in the middle of it, and that's the feedback circuit. And that that fancy light bulb in the cathode of that dual triode tool of the oscillator is what determines exactly the right amplitude, with no limiting going on in the tube itself. Therefore, all harmonics out of that tube oscillator probably are 60 decibels suppressed. Therefore, you put that pure oscillator into your amplifier under test. At the amplitude you want to put it under, maybe your amplifier is rated for 10 watts, and you adjust it for 10 watts of output into a resistive load. Let me drop. You then put that voltage into a Hewlett Packard total distortion analyzer. The total distortion analyzer first takes a full-scale deflection, very similar to the way you and I measure standing wave ratio. You set it up for full-scale deflection with the signal coming out of your amplifier under test. Then you adjust the dials on the total distortion analyzer, which is another kind of a Weinbridge circuit, which creates a perfect null at the oscillating frequency, like 1 kilohertz. And you create a 60 decibel null at that frequency. You juggle the dials back and forth until you get the minimum reading on the output meter. And then sometimes you've got that scale changes, and you measure how many decibels down is all the frequency components left over from your amplifier when 1 kilohertz is going in, when you've suppressed the 1 kilohertz in your testing instrument. That's how you measure total harmonic distortion. Beautiful way of doing it. I cut my teeth in 1958 at Telephonics Corporation, measuring the audio amplifiers that they were using for their aircraft intercom system. Let me drop. It was a transistorized amplifier. I'm trying to remember, 2N535 or something like that was the actual amplifying transistors. And that's the way the Hewlett Packard oscillator into a Hewlett Packard total distortion analyzer. It confirmed the fidelity of those intercom amplifiers used on the aircraft intercom system. That's how the microphone amplified the signal that went through the aircraft and went through all the earphones of all the other operators on that aircraft. And so you wanted the total harmonic distortion to be low enough so you had enough fidelity so you could understand what the hell the pilot was saying when he's giving orders to the bombardier, if you know what I mean. So making an oscillator have very low harmonic distortion without a light bulb, you'd be amazed how difficult that is to do. Any other kind of limiting device is going to be generating harmonics. A light bulb as a variable resistor throughout every degree of the sine wave of the oscillation of the waveform being generated, thermal capacity, thermal inertia. Let me drop. The light bulb circuit has probably a thermal time constant of around 1 or 2 seconds, and if your oscillator is running at 20 hertz or 1 kilohertz, there is essentially zero change in resistance of the tungsten filament of that light bulb circuit as it's changing its resistance as a function of amplitude. It's a really beautiful technique. You try to do that with solid-state circuits, like field-effect transistors being used in the cutoff mode, or varector diodes. You try to use any other kind of peak-to-peak diode limiting, for instance, in order to set the amplitude of your oscillator. You will be generating harmonics. Only a light bulb doesn't do it. It's a slim possibility that a pin diode, carefully chosen, can do it. Although to try to find a pin diode that operates correctly at such low audio frequencies, that would be a problem. Y, or so you guys know a little bit more about oscillators and how to make them pure. And Hewlett-Packard solved that problem, and that was the beginning of a multi-billion dollar corporation. In fact, that garage in Palo Alto, let me drop one.
Comment, Dick.
That garage in the backyard of either Mr. Hewlett or Mr. Packard is now considered a national monument. That one-car garage where they did this development is now a national monument and is being preserved. That's what set the Hewlett-Packard company off. Casey, K6DPZ, KQRI, go ahead, Al.
Also, I want to make the comment that the oscillator has a 600 ohm output speed and frequency. The reason being, they not only sold them into Disney, they also sold them into the phone company and broadcast stations where they use 600 ohm impedance for moving around most of their audio systems. I don't know if you're aware of that or not.
Yeah, the nice thing about that oscillator is it could put out a maximum of something like 1 milliwatt. 1 milliwatt on a 600 ohm line, as I remember, something like 260 millivolts. So it had a beautiful output attenuator and a volume control, so you could use that Hewlett-Packard Model 200 audio oscillator. You could make lots of different millivolts and volts of output at an exact frequency. Beautiful, great big dial on it. In the case of broadcast, Eric, is 600 ohms a standard frequency, standard impedance used for audio circuits for broadcast, KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW and K2EJ. No, there's a couple different standards. Actually, 600 ohms in the old days, it's 600 ohms at plus 4 dBm or plus 8 dBm, depending upon whether you were decided to stick with the Western Electric standards or the broadcast standards. Actually, most of it today is 0 dBm. Although, microphones, actually, they have an XLR connector. It's considered to be balanced 600 ohms, but actually, if the source impedance is a microphone, it's usually 150 ohms. But the reality of today is, since we don't pipe around analog audio anymore, we use 110 ohm cable for a balanced cable if we're doing balanced line, and if you want to do it single ended, we use transformers that go from 600 ohms balanced to 75 ohms unbalanced.
A comment I want to make, Dick.
Okay, I'm going to first ask Eric a question on that and turn it over to you, Hal. Are many of your audio circuits fully balanced dual conductor inside of a shielded cable, push-pull, in other words, I think they call it full differential in order to get humbucking, KE2EJ, K2IW?
Now I'll consider this. In a microphone, you're going to be generating a signal that's maybe 200 to 300 millivolts. You might be stepping that through 150 feet of cable to 100 feet of cable. So, if you did that single-ended and shielded, you're going to have lots of problems with hum and conduction and all sorts of weird stuff. So, we generally low-level signals being sent on a truly differential balanced line, you don't have those problems.
Yeah, I'm going to give you guys a couple of words on that one. You take something like a double shielded piece of RG214 coaxial cable, or I'm trying to remember, RG223 is the PNC size cable, even a quarter inch diameter, which with double shielding, good common sense would lead you to believe no 60 cycle hum would go through there. Oh boy, you're wrong on that one. When you get down to a low enough frequency, the depth of penetration of a magnetic signal near a transformer will go into that cable of yours and give you lots of hum pickup. But if inside of the cable you don't have one single conductor, you've got two conductors being used in a fully differential manner,